In a soft, automatic way, he had become spokesman. He said, "Not the grandfather of the oldest can recall a time in which the lords were absent. It has been a time of peace. It has been a time of peace." He hesitated. "The governor is a strong and powerful lord who would not hesitate to punish traitors. None of us are traitors, of course. He has punished some in the past, I imagine, as they deserve." Again, hesitation. "None here have ever been traitors, or our fathers, or our fathers' fathers. But on other worlds there have been such, and death followed for them quickly. It is not good to think of, for we are humble men who are poor farmers and not concerned with matters of politics." The anxiety in his voice, the universal concern in the eyes of all of them, was obvious. Pritchier said smoothly, "Could you inform us as to how we can arrange an audience with your governor?" And instantly an element of sudden bewilderment entered the situation. For after a long moment, the elder said, "Why, did you not know? The governor will be here tomorrow. He has expected you. It has been a great honor for us. We hope earnestly that you will report to him satisfactorily as to our loyalty to him." Pritchard's smile scarcely twitched. "Expected us?" The elder looked wonderingly from one to the other. "Why, it is now a week since we have been waiting for you." Their quarters were undoubtedly luxurious for the world. Pritcher had lived in worse. Janice showed nothing but indifference to externals. But there was an element of tension between them of a different nature than hitherto. Pritcher felt the time approaching for a definite decision, and yet there was still the desirability of additional waiting. To see the governor first would be to increase the gamble to dangerous dimensions, and yet to win that gamble might multi-double the winnings. He felt a surge of anger at the slight crease between Chanice's eyebrows, the delicate uncertainty with which the young man's lower lip presented itself to an upper tooth. He detested the useless play-acting and yearned for an end to it. He said, "We seem to be anticipated." "Yes," said Chanice simply. "Just that? You have no contribution of greater pith to make? We come here and find that the governor expects us. Presumably we shall find from the governor that Tazenda itself expects us. Of what value, then, is our entire mission?" Janice looked up, without endeavoring to conceal the weary note in his voice. "To expect us is one thing. To know who we are and what we came for is another. Do you expect to conceal these things from men of the Second Foundation?" "Perhaps. Why not? Are you ready to throw your hand in? Suppose our ship was detected in space. Is it unusual for a realm to maintain frontier observation posts? Even if we were ordinary strangers, we would be of interest. Sufficient reason for a governor to come to us rather than the reverse?" Janice shrugged. "We'll have to meet that problem later. Let us see what the governor is like." Pritchard bared his teeth in a bloodless kind of scowl. The situation was becoming ridiculous. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Pritchard bared his teeth in a bloodless kind of scowl. The situation was becoming ridiculous. Janice proceeded with an artificial animation. "At least we know one thing. Tazenda is the Second Foundation, or a million shreds of evidence are unanimously pointing the wrong way. How do you interpret the obvious terror in which these natives hold Tazenda? I see no signs of political domination. Their groups of elders apparently meet freely and without interference of any sort. The taxation they speak of doesn't seem at all extensive to me or efficiently carried through. The natives speak much of poverty, but seem sturdy and well-fed. The houses are uncouth and their village is rude, but are obviously adequate for the purpose. In fact, the world fascinates me. I have never seen a more forbidding one. Yet I am convinced that there is no suffering among the population, and that their uncomplicated lives manage to contain a well-balanced happiness, lacking in the sophisticated populations of the advanced centers." "Are you an admirer of peasant virtues, then?" "The stars forbid." Janice seemed amused at the idea. "I merely point out the significance of all this. Apparently, Tazenda is an efficient administrator, efficient in a sense far different from the efficiency of the old empire, or of the First Foundation, or even of our own Union. All these have brought mechanical efficiency to their subjects at the cost of more intangible values. Tazenda brings happiness and sufficiency. Don't you see that the whole orientation of their domination is different? It is not physical, but psychological. Really, Pritchard allowed himself irony. And the terror with which the elders spoke of the punishment of treason by these kind-hearted psychologist administrators? How does that suit your thesis? Were they the objects of the punishment? They speak of punishment only of others. It is as if knowledge of punishment has been so well implanted in them that punishment itself need never be used. The proper mental attitudes are so inserted into their minds that I am certain that not a Tazendian soldier exists on the planet. Don't you see all this?
I'll see perhaps, said Pritchard coldly, when I see the governor.
And what, by the way, if our mentalities are handled?
Chanis replied with brutal contempt.
You should be accustomed to that.
Pritchard whitened perceptibly, and with an effort, turned away. They spoke to one another no more that day. It was in the silent wildness of the frigid night, as he listened to the soft, sleeping motions of the other, that Pritchard silently adjusted his wrist transmitter to the ultra-wave region for which Chanis's was unadjustable, and with noiseless touches of his fingernail, contacted the ship. The answer came in little periods of noiseless vibration that barely lifted themselves above the sensory threshold. Twice Pritchard asked, "Any communications at all yet?" Twice the answer came, "None. We wait always." He got out of bed. It was cold in the room, and he pulled the furry blanket around him as he sat in the chair and stared out at the crowding stars, so different in the brightness and complexity of their arrangement from the even fog of the galactic lens that dominated the night sky of his native periphery. Somewhere there between the stars was the answer to the complications that overwhelmed him, and he felt the yearning for that solution to arrive and end things. For a moment he wondered again if the mule were right, if conversion had robbed him of the firm, sharp edge of self-reliance, or was it simply age and the fluctuations of these last years? He didn't really care. He was tired. The governor of Rossim arrived with minor ostentation. His only companion was the uniformed man at the controls of the ground car. The ground car itself was of lush design, but to Pritchard it appeared inefficient. It turned clumsily. More than once it apparently balked at what might have been a too rapid change of gears. It was obvious at once from its design that it ran on chemical and not on atomic fuel. The Tazendian governor stepped softly on to the thin layer of snow and advanced between two lines of respectful elders. He did not look at them, but entered quickly. They followed after him. From the quarters assigned to them, the two men of the Mule's Union watched. He, the governor, was thick-set, rather stocky, short, unimpressive. But what of that? Pritchard cursed himself for a failure of nerve. His face, to be sure, remained icily calm. There was no humiliation before Chanis, but he knew very well that his blood pressure had heightened and his throat had become dry. It was not a case of physical fear. He was not one of those dull-witted, unimaginative men of nerveless meat who were too stupid ever to be afraid. But physical fear he could account for and discount. But this was different. It was the other fear. He glanced quickly at Chanis. The young man glanced idly at the nails of one hand and poked leisurely at some trifling unevenness. Something inside Pritchard became vastly indignant. What had Chanis to fear of mental handling? Pritchard caught a mental breath and tried to think back. How had he been before the mule had converted him from the die-hard Democrat that he was? It was hard to remember. He could not place himself mentally. He could not break the clinging wires that bound him emotionally to the mule. Intellectually, he could remember that he had once tried to assassinate the mule, but not for all the straining he could endure could he remember his emotions at the time. That might be the self-defense of his own mind, however, for at the intuitive thought of what those emotions might have been, not realizing the details, but merely comprehending the drift of it, his stomach grew queasy. What if the governor tampered with his mind? What if the insubstantial mental tendrils of a second foundationeer insinuated itself down in the emotional crevices of his makeup and pulled them apart and rejoined them? There had been no sensation the first time. There had been no pain, no mental jar, not even a feeling of discontinuity. He had always loved the mule. If there had ever been a time long before, as long as 5 short years, when he had thought he hadn't loved him, that he had hated him, that was just a horrid illusion. The thought of that illusion embarrassed him. But there had been no pain. Would meeting the governor duplicate that? Would all that had gone before, all his service for the mule, all his life's orientation, join the hazy, other-life dream that held the word democracy? The mule also a dream, and only to Tazenda his loyalty. Sharply he turned away. There was that strong desire to retch. And then Chanis's voice clashed on his ear. "I think this is it, General." Pritchard turned again. An elder had opened the door silently and stood with a dignified and calm respect upon the threshold. He said, "His Excellency, Governor of Rossem, in the name of the Lords of Tazenda, is pleased to present his permission for an audience and request your appearance before him." "Sure thing." And Chanis tightened his belt with a jerk and adjusted a Rossemian hood over his head. Pritchard's jaw set. This was the beginning of the real gamble. The governor of Rossem was not of formidable appearance. For one thing, he was bareheaded, and his thinning hair, light brown, tending to gray, lent him mildness. His bony eye ridges lowered at them, and his eyes, set in a fine network of surrounding wrinkles, seemed calculating. But his fresh-cropped chin was soft and small, and by the universal convention of followers of the pseudoscience of reading character by facial bony structure, seemed weak. Pritchard avoided the eyes and watched the chin. He didn't know whether that would be effective, if anything would be. The governor's voice was high-pitched, indifferent. "Welcome to Tazenda. We greet you in peace. Have you eaten?" His hand, long fingers, gnarled veins, waved almost regally at the U-shaped table. They bowed and sat down. The governor sat at the outer edge of the base of the U, they on the inner. Along both arms sat the double row of silent elders. The governor spoke in short, abrupt sentences, praising the food as Tazendian importations, and it had indeed a quality different, if somehow not so much better, than the rougher food of the elders. Disparaging Rossemian weather, referring with an attempt at casualness to the intricacies of space travel. Chanis talked little, Pritchard not at all. Then it was over. The small stewed fruits were finished, the napkins used and discarded, and the governor leaned back. His small eyes sparkled. "I have inquired as to your ship. Naturally, I would like to see that it receives due care and overhaul. I am told its whereabouts are unknown." "True," Chanis replied lightly. "We have left it in space. It is a large ship, suitable for long journeys in sometimes hostile regions, and we felt that landing it here might give rise to doubts as to our peaceful intentions. We preferred to land alone, unarmed." "A friendly act," commented the governor without conviction. "A large ship, you say? Not a vessel of war, Excellency." "Where is it you come from?" "A small world of the Santani sector, Your Excellency. It may be you are not aware of its existence, for it lacks importance. We are interested in establishing trade relationships." "Trade, huh? And what have you to sell?" "Machines of all sorts, Excellency. In return, food, wood, ores." The governor seemed doubtful. "I know little of these matters. Perhaps mutual profit may be arranged. Perhaps, after I have examined your credentials at length, for much information will be required by my government before matters may proceed, you understand. And after I have looked over your ship, it would be advisable for you to proceed to Tazenda." There was no answer to that, and the governor's attitude iced perceptibly. "It is necessary that I see your ship, however." Chanis said distantly, "The ship, unfortunately, is undergoing repairs at the moment. If Your Excellency would not object to giving us 48 hours, it will be at your service." "I am not accustomed to waiting." For the first time, Pritchard met the glare of the other, eye to eye, and his breath exploded softly inside him. For a moment, he had the sensation of drowning, but then his eyes tore away. Chanis did not waver. He said, "The ship cannot be landed for 48 hours, Excellency. We are here and unarmed. Can you doubt our honest intentions?" There was a long silence, and then the governor said gruffly, "Tell me of the world from which you come." That was all. It passed with that. There was no more unpleasantness. The governor, having fulfilled his official duty, apparently lost interest, and the audience died a dull death. And when it was all over, Pritchard found himself back in their quarters and took stock of himself. Carefully, holding his breath, he felt his emotions. Certainly he seemed no different to himself, but would he feel any difference? Had he felt different after the mule's conversion? Had not everything seemed natural, as it should have been? He experimented. With cold purpose, he shouted inside the silent caverns of his mind, and the shout was, "The second foundation must be discovered and destroyed." And the emotion that accompanied it was honest hate. There was not as much as a hesitation involved in it. And then it was in his mind to substitute the word mule for the phrase second foundation, and his breath caught at the mere emotion, and his tongue clogged. So far, good. But had he been handled otherwise, more subtly, had tiny changes been made, changes that he couldn't detect because their very existence warped his judgment, there was no way to tell. But he still felt absolute loyalty to the mule. If that were unchanged, nothing else really mattered. He turned his mind to action again. Janice was busy at his end of the room. Pritchard's thumbnail idled at his wrist communicator. And then, at the response that came, he felt a wave of relief surge over him and leave him weak. The quiet muscles of his face did not betray him, but inside he was shouting with joy. And when Chanis turned to face him, he knew that the farce was about over. Fourth Interlude. The two speakers passed each other on the road, and one stopped the other. "I have word from the first speaker." There was a half-apprehensive flicker in the other's eyes. "Intersection point?" "Yes. May we live to see the dawn." Chapter 5. One Man and the Mule. There was no sign in any of Chanis's actions that he was aware of any subtle change in the attitude of Pritchard and in their relations to each other. He leaned back on the hard wooden bench and spread-eagled his feet out in front of him. "What did you make of the governor?" Pritchard shrugged. "Nothing at all. He certainly seemed no mental genius to me. A very poor specimen of the Second Foundation, if that's what he was supposed to be. I don't think he was, you know. I'm not sure what to make of it." "Suppose you were a Second Foundationer." Janice grew thoughtful. "What would you do? Suppose you had an idea of our purpose here. How would you handle us?" "Conversion, of course." "Like the mule?" Janice looked up sharply. "Would we know if they had converted us?" "I wonder. And what if they were simply psychologists, but very clever ones?" "In that case, I'd have us killed rather quickly." "And our ship?" "No." Janice wagged a forefinger. "We're playing a bluff, Pritchard, old man. It can only be a bluff. Even if they have emotional control down pat, we, you and I, are only fronts. It's the mule they must fight, and they're being just as careful of us as we are of them. I'm assuming that they know who we are." Pritchard stared coldly. "What do you intend doing?" "Wait." The word was bitten off. "Let them come to us. They're worried, maybe about the ship, but probably about the mule. They bluffed with the governor. It didn't work. We stayed pat. The next person they'll send will be a second foundationer, and he'll propose a deal of some sort. And then?" "And then we make the deal." "I don't think so." "Because you think it will double-cross the mule." "It won't." "No, the mule could handle your double crosses, any you could invent. But I still don't think so." "Because you think then we couldn't double-cross the Foundationers?" "Perhaps not, but that's not the reason." Janice let his glance drop to what the other held in his fist and said grimly, "You mean that's the reason?" Pritchard cradled his blaster. "That's right. You are under arrest." "Why?" "For treason to the first citizen of the Union." Chanis's lips hardened on one another. "What's going on?" "Treason, as I said, and correction of the matter on my part." "Your proof, or evidence, assumptions, daydreams? Are you mad?" "No, are you? Do you think the mule sends out unweaned youngsters on ridiculous swashbuckling missions for nothing? It was queer to me at the time, but I wasted time in doubting myself. Why should he send you? Because you smile and dress well? Because you're 28? Perhaps because I can be trusted. Or aren't you in the market for logical reasons? Or perhaps because you can't be trusted, which is logical enough, as it turns out. Are we matching paradoxes, or is all this a word game to see who can say the least in the most words? And the blaster advanced, with Pritchard after it. He stood erect before the younger man. Stand up. Janice did so, in no particular hurry, and felt the muzzle of the blaster touch his belt, with no shrinking of the stomach muscles. Pritchard said, What the mule wanted was to find the second foundation. He had failed, and I had failed, and the secret that neither of us can find is a well-hidden one. So there was one outstanding possibility left, and that was to find a seeker who already knew the hiding place. Is that I? Apparently it was. I didn't know then, of course, but though my mind must be slowing, it still points in the right direction. How easily we found Star's End. How miraculously you examined the correct field region of the lens from among an infinite number of possibilities. And having done so, how nicely we observed just the correct point for observation. You clumsy fool! Did you so underestimate me that no combination of impossible fortuities struck you as being too much for me to swallow? You mean I've been too successful? Too successful by half for any loyal man? Because the standards of success you set me were so low? And the blaster prodded, though in the face that confronted Janice, only the cold glitter of the eyes betrayed the growing anger. Because you are in the pay of the second foundation. Pay? Infinite contempt. Prove that. Or under the mental influence. Without the mule's knowledge? Ridiculous. With the mule's knowledge. Exactly my point, my young dullard. With the mule's knowledge. Do you suppose else that you would be given a ship to play with? You led us to the second foundation as you were supposed to do. I thresh a kernel of something or other out of this immensity of chaff. May I ask why I'm supposed to be doing all this? If I were a traitor, why should I lead you to the second foundation? Why not hither and yon through the galaxy, skipping gaily, finding no more than you ever did? For the sake of the ship, and because the men of the second foundation quite obviously need atomic warfare for self-defense. You'll have to do better than that. One ship won't mean anything to them, and if they think they'll learn science from it and build atomic power plants next year, they are very, very simple second foundationers indeed. On the order of simplicity as yourself, I should say. You will have the opportunity to explain that to the mule. We're going back to Calgan? On the contrary, we're staying here, and the mule will join us in 15 minutes, more or less. Do you think he hasn't followed us, my sharp-witted, nimble-minded lump of self-admiration? You have played the decoy well in reverse. You may not have led our victims to us, but you have certainly led us to our victims. May I sit down, said Janice, and explain something to you in picture drawings, please? You will remain standing. At that, I can say it is well standing. You think the mule followed us because of the hypertracer on the communication circuit? The blaster might have wavered. Janice couldn't have sworn to it. He said, You don't look surprised, but I don't waste time doubting that you feel surprised. Yes, I knew about it. And now, having shown you that I knew of something you didn't think I did, I'll tell you something you don't know, that I know you don't. You allow yourself too many preliminaries, Janice. I should think your sense of invention was more smoothly greased. There's an invention to this. There have been traitors, of course, or enemy agents, if you prefer that term. But the mule knew of that in a rather curious way. It seems, you see, that some of his converted men have been tampered with. The blaster did waver that time, unmistakably. I emphasized that, Pritchard. It was why he needed me. I was an unconverted man. Didn't he emphasize to you that he needed an unconverted, whether he gave you the real reason or not? Try something else, Janice. If I were against the mule, I'd know it. Quietly, rapidly, Pritchard was feeling his mind. It felt the same. It felt the same. Obviously, the man was lying. You mean you feel loyal to the mule? Perhaps. Loyalty wasn't tampered with. Too easily detectable, the mule said. But how do you feel mentally? Sluggish? Since you started the trip, Have you always felt normal? Or have you felt strange sometimes, as though you weren't quite yourself? What are you trying to do, bore a hole through me without touching the trigger?
Pritchard withdrew his blaster half an inch.
What are you trying to say?
I say that you've been tampered with. You've been handled. You didn't see the mule install that hypertracer. You didn't see anyone do it. You just found it there and assumed it was the mule, and ever since you've been assuming he was following us. Sure, the wrist receiver you're wearing contacts the ship on a wavelength mine isn't good for. You think I didn't know that?
He was speaking quickly now, angrily. His cloak of indifference had dissolved into savagery.
But it's not the mule that's coming toward us from out there. It's not the mule.
Who, if not?
Well, who do you suppose? I found that hypertracer the day we left, but I didn't think it was the mule. He had no reason for indirection at that point. Don't you see the nonsense of it? If I were a traitor and he knew that, I could be converted as easily as you were, and he would have the secret of the location of the second foundation out of my mind without sending me half across the galaxy. Can you keep a secret from the mule? And if I didn't know, then I couldn't lead him to it, so why send me in either case? Obviously, that hypertracer must have been put there by an agent of the second foundation. That's who's coming towards us now. And would you have been fooled if your precious mind hadn't been tampered with? What kind of normality have you that you imagine immense folly to be wisdom? Me bring a ship to the second foundation? What would they do with a ship? It's you they want, Pritchard. You know more about the Union than anyone but the mule, and you're not dangerous to them while he is. That's why they put the direction of search into my mind. Of course it was completely impossible for me to find Tazenda by random searchings of the lens. I knew that. But I knew there was the second foundation after us, and I knew they engineered it. Why not play their game? It was a battle of bluffs. They wanted us, and I wanted their location. And space take the one that couldn't outbluff the other. But it's we that will lose as long as you hold that blaster on me. And it obviously isn't your idea. It's theirs. Give me the blaster, Pritchard. I know it seems wrong to you, but it isn't your mind speaking. It's the second foundation within you. Give me the blaster, Pritchard, and we'll face what's coming now. Together.
Pritchard faced a growing confusion in horror. Plausibility. Could he be so wrong? Why this eternal doubt of himself? Why wasn't he sure? What made Channis sound so plausible? Plausibility. Or was it his own tortured mind fighting the invasion of the alien? Was he split in two? Hazily, he saw Channis standing before him, hand outstretched. And suddenly, he knew he was going to give him the blaster. And as the muscles of his arm were on the point of contracting in the proper manner to do so, the door opened, not hastily, behind him, and he turned. There are perhaps men in the galaxy who can be confused for one another, even by men at their peaceful leisure. Correspondingly, there may be conditions of mind when even unlikely pairs may be misrecognized. But the mule rises above any combination of the two factors. Not all Pritchard's agony of mind prevented the instantaneous mental flood of cool vigor that engulfed him. Physically, the mule could not dominate any situation, nor did he dominate this one. He was a rather ridiculous figure in his layers of clothing that thickened him past his normality, without allowing him to reach normal dimensions even so. His face was muffled, and the usually dominant beak covered what was left in a cold red prominence. Probably as a vision of rescue, no greater incongruity could exist. He said, "Keep your blaster, Pritchard." Then he turned to Channis, who had shrugged and seated himself. The emotional context here seems rather confusing and considerably in conflict. "What's this about someone other than myself following you?"
Pritchard intervened sharply.
"Was a hypertracer placed upon our ship by your orders, sir?"
The mule turned cool eyes upon him.
"Certainly. Is it very likely that any organization in the galaxy, other than the Union of Worlds, would have access to it?" He said, "Well, he's here, General. Indirect quotation is not necessary." "Have you been saying anything, Channis?"
"Yes, but mistakes, apparently, sir. It has been my opinion that the tracer was put there by someone in the pay of the Second Foundation, and that we had been led here for some purpose of theirs, which I was prepared to counter. I was under the further impression that the General was more or less in their hands."
"You sound as if you think so no longer."
"I'm afraid not, or it would not have been you at the door."
"Well then, let's thresh this out." The mule peeled off the outer layers of padded and electrically heated clothing.
Do you mind if I sit down as well? Now, we are safe here and perfectly free of any danger of intrusion. No native of this lump of ice will have any desire to approach this place. I assure you of that. There was a grim earnestness about his insistence upon his powers. Chanis showed his disgust. Why privacy? Is someone going to serve tea and bring out the dancing girls? Scarcely. What was this theory of yours, young man? A second foundationer was tracing you with a device which no one but I have, and how did you say you found this place? Apparently, sir, it seems obvious, in order to account for known facts, that certain notions have been put into my head by these same second foundationers? No one else, I imagine. Then it did not occur to you that if a second foundationer could force or entice or inveigle you into going to the second foundation for purposes of his own, and I assume you imagined he used methods similar to mine, though, mind you, I can implant only emotions, not ideas. It did not occur to you that if he could do that, there was little necessity to put a hypertracer on you? And Chanis looked up sharply and met his sovereign's large eyes with sudden startle. Pritchard grunted, and a visible relaxation showed itself in his shoulders. No, said Chanis, that hadn't occurred to me. Or that if they were obliged to trace you, they couldn't feel capable of directing you, and that undirected you could have precious little chance of finding your way here as you did? Did that occur to you? That neither. Why not? As your intellectual level receded to a so much greater than probable degree? The only answer is a question, sir. Are you joining General Pritchard in accusing me of being a traitor? You have a defense in case I am? Only the one I presented to the general. If I were a traitor and knew the whereabouts of the Second Foundation, you could convert me and learn the knowledge directly. If you felt it necessary to trace me, then I hadn't the knowledge beforehand and wasn't a traitor. So I answer your paradox with another. Then your conclusion, that I am not a traitor, to which I must agree, since your argument is irrefutable. Then may I ask why you had us secretly followed? Because to all the facts, there is a third explanation. Both you and Pritchard explained some facts in your own individual ways, but not all. I, if you can spare me the time, will explain all, and in a rather short time, so there is little danger of boredom. Sit down, Pritchard, and give me your blaster. There is no danger of attack on us any longer. None from in here, and none from out there. None, in fact, even from the Second Foundation. Thanks to you, Chanis. The room was lit in the usual Rosemian fashion of electrically heated wire. A single bulb was suspended from the ceiling, and in its dim yellow glow, the three cast their individual shadows. This book is continued on cassette number 3. The room was lit in the usual Rosemian fashion of electrically heated wire. A single bulb was suspended from the ceiling, and in its dim yellow glow, the three cast their individual shadows. The mule said, "Since I felt it necessary to trace Chanis, it was obvious I expect to gain something thereby. Since he went to the Second Foundation with a startling speed and directness, we can reasonably assume that that was what I was expecting to happen. Since I did not gain the knowledge from him directly, something must have been preventing me. Those are the facts. Chanis, of course, knows the answer. So do I. Do you see it, Pritchard?" And Pritchard said doggedly, "No, sir." "Then I'll explain. Only one kind of man can both know the location of the Second Foundation and prevent me from learning it. Chanis, I'm afraid you're a Second Foundationer yourself." And Chanis's elbows rested on his knees as he leaned forward, and through stiff and angry lips said, "What is your direct evidence? Deduction has proven wrong twice today." "There is direct evidence, too, Chanis. It was easy enough. I told you that my men had been tampered with. The tamperer must have been, obviously, someone who was A, unconverted, and B, fairly close to the center of things. The field was large, but not entirely unlimited. You were too successful, Chanis. People liked you too much. You got along too well. I wondered. And then I summoned you to take over this expedition, and it didn't set you back. I watched your emotions. It didn't bother you. You overplayed the confidence there, Chanis. No man of real competence could have avoided a dash of uncertainty at a job like that. Since your mind did avoid it, it was either a foolish one or a controlled one.
It was easy to test the alternatives. I seized your mind at a moment of relaxation and filled it with grief for an instant and then removed it. You were angry afterwards with such accomplished art that I could have sworn it was a natural reaction, but for that which went first. For when I wrenched at your emotions, just for one instant, for one tiny instant before you could catch yourself, your mind resisted. It was all I needed to know. No one could have resisted me, even for that tiny instant, without control similar to mine. Janice's voice was low and bitter. Well then, now what? And now you die, as a second foundationer, quite necessary, as I believe you realize. And once again, Janice stared into the muzzle of a blaster, a muzzle guided this time by a mind, not like Pritchard's, capable of offhand twisting to suit himself, but by one as mature as his own, and as resistant to force as his own. And the period of time allotted him for a correction of events was small. What followed thereafter is difficult to describe by one with the normal complement of senses and the normal incapacity for emotional control. Essentially, this is what Janice realized in the tiny space of time involved in the pushing of the mule's thumb upon the trigger contact. The mule's current emotional makeup was one of a hard and polished determination, unmisted by hesitation in the least. Had Janice been sufficiently interested afterward to calculate the time involved from the determination to shoot to the arrival of the disintegrating energies, he might have realized that his leeway was about 1/5 of a second. That was barely time. What the mule realized in that same tiny space of time was that the emotional potential of Chanis's brain had surged suddenly upwards without his own mind feeling any impact, and that simultaneously a flood of pure, thrilling hatred cascaded upon him from an unexpected direction. It was that new emotional element that jerked his thumb off the contact. Nothing else could have done it, and almost together with his change of action came complete realization of the new situation. It was a tableau that endured far less than the significance adhering to it should require from a dramatic standpoint. There was the mule, thumb off the blaster, staring intently upon Janice. There was Janice, taut, not quite daring to breathe yet. And there was Pritchard, convulsed in his chair, every muscle at a spasmodic breaking point, every tendon writhing in an effort to hurl forward. His face twisted at last out of schooled woodenness into an unrecognizable death mask of horrid hate, and his eyes only and entirely and supremely upon the mule. Only a word or two passed between Janice and the mule. Only a word or two, and that utterly revealing stream of emotional consciousness that remains forever the true interplay of understanding between such as they. For the sake of our own limits, it is necessary to translate into words what went on, then, and thenceforward. Janice said tensely, "You're between two fires, First Citizen. You can't control two minds simultaneously, not when one of them is mine. So you have your choice. Pritchard is free of your conversion now. I've snapped the bonds. He's the old Pritchard, the one who tried to kill you once, the one who thinks you're the enemy of all that is free and right and holy. And he's the one, besides, who knows that you've debased him to helpless adulation for 5 years. I'm holding him back now by suppressing his will. But if you kill me, that ends. And in considerably less time than you could shift your blaster or even your will, he will kill you." The mule quite plainly realized that. He did not move. Janice continued, "If you turn to place him under control, to kill him, to do anything, you won't ever be quick enough to turn again to stop me." The mule still did not move, only a soft sigh of realization. "So," said Janice, "throw down the blaster, and let us be on even terms again, and you can have Pritchard back." "I made a mistake," said the mule finally. "It was wrong to have a third party present when I confronted you. It introduced one variable too many. It is a mistake that must be paid for, I suppose." He dropped the blaster carelessly and kicked it to the other end of the room. Simultaneously, Pritchard crumpled into profound sleep. "He'll be normal when he awakes," said the mule indifferently. The entire exchange, from the time the mule's thumb had begun pressing the trigger contact to the time he dropped the blaster, had occurred just under a second and a half of time. But just beneath the borders of consciousness, for a time just above the borders of detection, Janice caught a furtive emotional gleam in the mule's mind. And it was still one of sure and confident triumph. Chapter 6. One Man, the Mule, and Another. Two men, apparently relaxed and entirely at ease, poles apart physically, with every nerve that served as emotional detector quivering tensely. The mule, for the first time in long years, had insufficient surety of his own way. Janus knew that, though he could protect himself for the moment, it was an effort, and that the attack upon him was none such for his opponent. In a test of endurance, Janus knew he would lose, but it was deadly to think of that. To give away to the mule an emotional weakness would be to hand him a weapon. There was already that glimpse of something, a winner's something, in the mule's mind. To gain time. Why did the others delay? Was that the source of the mule's confidence? What did his opponent know that he didn't? The mind he watched told nothing. If only he could read ideas. And yet, Janus braked his own mental whirling roughly. There was only that, to gain time. Janus said, "Since it is decided, and not denied by myself after our little duel over Pritcher, that I am a second foundationer, suppose you tell me why I came to Tazenda." "Oh, no," and the mule laughed with high-pitched confidence. "I am not Pritcher. I need make no explanations to you. You had what you thought were reasons. Whatever they were, your actions suited me, and so I inquire no further. Yet there must be such gaps in your conception of the story. Is Tazenda the second foundation you expected to find? Pritcher spoke much of your other attempt at finding it, and of your psychological tool, Ebling Miz. He babbled a bit sometimes under my, slight encouragement. Think back on Ebling Miz, first citizen. Why should I? Confidence." Janus felt that confidence edge out into the open, as if with the passage of time, any anxiety the mule might be having was increasingly vanishing. He said, firmly restraining the rush of desperation, "You lack curiosity, then. Pritcher told me of Miz's vast surprise at something. There was his terribly drastic urging for speed, for a rapid warning of the second foundation. Why? Why? Ebling Miz died. The second foundation was not warned. And yet, the second foundation exists." The mule smiled in real pleasure, and with a sudden and surprising dash of cruelty that Janus felt advance and suddenly withdraw. "But apparently the second foundation was warned. Else how and why did one Bale Janus arrive on Calgan to handle my men, and to assume the rather thankless task of outwitting me? The warning came too late, that is all." Then, and Janus allowed pity to drench outward from him, "You don't even know what the second foundation is, or anything of the deeper meaning of all that has been going on." To gain time. The mule felt the other's pity, and his eyes narrowed with instant hostility. He rubbed his nose in his familiar four-finger gesture and snapped, "Amuse yourself, then. What of the second foundation?" Janus spoke deliberately, in words, rather than in emotional symbology. He said, "From what I have heard, it was the mystery that surrounded the second foundation that most puzzled Miz. Harry Seldon founded his two units so differently. The first foundation was a splurge that in two centuries dazzled half the galaxy, and the second was an abyss that was dark. You won't understand why that was, unless you can once again feel the intellectual atmosphere of the days of the dying empire. It was a time of absolutes, of the great final generalities, at least in thought. It was a sign of decaying culture, of course, that dams had been built against the further development of ideas. It was his revolt against these dams that made Seldon famous. It was that one last spark of youthful creation in him that lit the empire in a sunset glow and dimly foreshadowed the rising sun of the second empire." "Very dramatic. So what?" "So he created his foundations according to the laws of psychohistory. But who knew better than he that even those laws were relative? He never created a finished product. Finished products are for decadent minds. His was an evolving mechanism, and the second foundation was the instrument of that evolution. We, first citizen of your temporary union of worlds, we are the guardians of Seldon's plan. Only we." "Are you trying to talk yourself into courage?" inquired the mule contemptuously. "Or are you trying to impress me? For the second foundation, Seldon's plan, the second empire, all impresses me not in the least, nor touches any spring of compassion, sympathy, responsibility, nor any other source of emotional aid you may be trying to tap in me. And in any case, poor fool, speak of the second foundation in the past tense, for it is destroyed. Chanis felt the emotional potential that pressed upon his mind rise in intensity as the mule rose from his chair and approached. He fought back furiously, but something crept relentlessly on within him, battering and bending his mind back, and back. He felt the wall behind him, and the mule faced him, skinny arms akimbo, lips smiling terribly beneath that mountain of nose. The mule said, "Your game is through, Chanis. The game of all of you, of all the men of what used to be the Second Foundation. Used to be. Used to be. What were you sitting here waiting for all this time, with your babble to Pritcher, when you might have struck him down and taken the blaster from him without the least effort of physical force? You were waiting for me, weren't you? Waiting to greet me in a situation that would not too arouse my suspicions. Too bad for you that I needed no arousal. I knew you. I knew you well, Chanis of the Second Foundation. But what are you waiting for now? You still throw words at me desperately, as though the mere sound of your voice would freeze me to my seat. And all the while you speak, something in your mind is waiting, and waiting, and is still waiting. But no one is coming. None of those you expect. None of your allies. You are alone here, Chanis, and you will remain alone. Do you know why? It is because your second foundation miscalculated me to the very dregs of the end. I knew their plan early. They thought I would follow you here and be proper meat for their cooking. You were to be a decoy indeed, a decoy for a poor, foolish, weakling mutant, so hot on the trail of empire that he would fall blindly into an obvious pit. But am I their prisoner? I wonder if it occurred to them that I'd scarcely be here without my fleet, against the artillery of any unit of which they are entirely and pitifully helpless. Did it occur to them that I would not pause for discussion or wait for events? My ships were launched against Tazenda 12 hours ago, and they are quite through with their mission. Tazenda is laid in ruins. Its centers of population are wiped out. There was no resistance. The Second Foundation no longer exists, Chanis. And I, the queer, ugly weakling, am the ruler of the galaxy. Chanis could do nothing but shake his head feebly. No. No. Yes. Yes. Mimicked the mule. And if you are the last one alive, and you may be, that will not be for long either. And then there followed a short, pregnant pause, and Chanis almost howled with the sudden pain of that tearing penetration of the innermost tissues of his mind. The mule drew back and muttered, "Not enough. You do not pass the test after all. Your despair is pretense. Your fear is not the broad, overwhelming that adheres to the destruction of an ideal, but the puny, seeping fear of personal destruction." And the mule's weak hand seized Chanis by the throat in a puny grip that Chanis was somehow unable to break. "You are my insurance, Chanis. You are my director and safeguard against any underestimation I may make." The mule's eyes bored down upon him, insistent, demanding. "Have I calculated rightly, Chanis? Have I outwitted your men of the Second Foundation? Tazenda is destroyed, Chanis, tremendously destroyed. So why is your despair pretense? Where is the reality? I must have reality and truth. Talk, Chanis, talk. Have I penetrated then not deeply enough? Does the danger still exist? Talk, Chanis. Where have I done wrong?" Chanis felt the words drag out of his mouth. They did not come willingly. He clenched his teeth against them. He bit his tongue. He tensed every muscle of his throat. And they came out, gasping, pulled out by force and tearing his throat and tongue and teeth on the way. "Truth!" he squeaked. "Truth!" "Yes, truth. What is left to be done? Selden founded Second Foundation here. Here, as I said. I told no lie. The psychologists arrived and took control of the native population." "Of Tazenda?" The mule plunged deeply into the flooding torture of the other's emotional upwellings, tearing at them brutally. "It is Tazenda I have destroyed. You know what I want. Give it to me." "Not Tazenda.
I said second foundationers might not be those apparently in power. Tazenda is the figurehead.
The words were almost unrecognizable, forming themselves against every atom of the will of the second foundationer.
Rossim! Rossim! Rossim is the world!
The mule loosed his grip, and Chanis dropped into a huddle of pain and torture.
And you thought to fool me, said the mule softly.
You were fooled. It was the last dying shred of resistance in Chanis.
But not long enough for you and yours. I am in communication with my fleet, and after Tazenda can come Rossim. But first...
Chanis felt the excruciating darkness rise against him, and the automatic lift of his arm to his tortured eyes could not ward it off. It was a darkness that throttled, and as he felt his torn, wounded mind reeling backwards, backwards into the everlasting black, there was that final picture of the triumphant mule, laughing matchstick, that long, fleshy nose quivering with laughter. The sound faded away. The darkness embraced him lovingly. It ended with a cracking sensation that was like the jagged glare of a lightning flash, and Janice came slowly to earth while sight returned painfully, in blurry transmission through tear-drenched eyes. His head ached unbearably, and it was only with a stab of agony that he could bring up a hand to it. Obviously, he was alive. Softly, like feathers caught up in an eddy of air that had passed, his thoughts steadied and drifted to rest. He felt comfort suck in from outside. Slowly, torturedly, he bent his neck, and relief was a sharp pang. For the door was open, and the first speaker stood just inside the threshold. He tried to speak, to shout, to warn, but his tongue froze, and he knew that a part of the mule's mighty mind still held him and clamped all speech within him. He bent his neck once more. The mule was still in the room. He was angry and hot-eyed. He laughed no longer, but his teeth were bared in a ferocious smile. Chanis felt the first speaker's mental influence moving gently over his mind with a healing touch, and then there was the numbing sensation as it came into contact with the mule's defense for an instant of struggle, and withdrew. The mule said gratingly, with a fury that was grotesque in his meager body,
"Then another comes to greet me."
His agile mind reached its tendrils out of the room. Out, out.
"You are alone," he said.
And the first speaker interrupted with an acquiescence. "I am thoroughly alone. It is necessary that I be alone, since it was I who miscalculated your future 5 years ago. There would be a certain satisfaction to me in correcting that matter without aid. Unfortunately, I did not count on the strength of your field of emotional repulsion that surrounded this place. It took me long to penetrate. I congratulate you upon the skill with which it was constructed."
"Thank you for nothing," came the hostile rejoinder. "Bandy no compliments with me. Have you come to add your brain splinter to that of yon cracked pillar of your realm?"
The first speaker smiled.
"Why, the man you call Bale Chanis performed his mission well. The more so, since he was not your mental equal by far. I can see, of course, that you have mistreated him, yet it may be that we may restore him fully even yet. He is a brave man, sir. He volunteered for this mission, although we were able to predict mathematically the huge chance of damage to his mind. A more fearful alternative than that of mere physical crippling."
Janice's mind pulsed futilely with what he wanted to say, and couldn't. The warning he wished to shout, and was unable to. He could only emit that continuous stream of fear. Fear. The mule was calm. "You know, of course, of the destruction of Tazenda?"
"I do. The assault by your fleet was foreseen."
Grimly.
"Yes, so I suppose. But not prevented, huh?"
"No, not prevented." The first speaker's emotional symbology was plain. It was almost a self-horror, a complete self-disgust. "And the fault is much more mine than yours. Who could have imagined your powers 5 years ago? We suspected from the start, from the moment you captured Kalkan, that you had the powers of emotional control. That was not too surprising, First Citizen, as I can explain to you. Emotional contact, such as you and I possess, is not a very new development. Actually, it is implicit in the human brain. Most humans can read emotion in a primitive manner by associating it pragmatically with facial expression, tone of voice, and so on. A good many animals possess the faculty to a higher degree. They use the sense of smell to a good extent,
and the emotions involved are, of course, less complex. Actually, humans are capable of much more, but the faculty of direct emotional contact tended to atrophy with the development of speech a million years back. It has been the great advance of our second foundation that this forgotten sense has been restored to at least some of its potentialities. But we are not born with its full use. A million years of decay is a formidable obstacle, and we must educate the sense, exercise it as we exercise our muscles. And there you have the main difference. You were born with it. So much we could calculate. We could also calculate the effect of such a sense upon a person in a world of men who did not possess it, the seeing man in the kingdom of the blind. We calculated the extent to which a megalomania would take control of you, and we thought we were prepared. But for two factors, we were not prepared. The first was the great extent of your sense. We can induce emotional contact only when in eyeshot, which is why we are more helpless against physical weapons than you might think. Sight plays such an enormous part. Not so with you. You are definitely known to have had men under control, and further, to have had intimate emotional contact with them when out of sight and out of earshot. That was discovered too late. Secondly, we did not know of your physical shortcomings, particularly the one that seemed so important to you, that you adopted the name of the Mule. We didn't foresee that you were not merely a mutant, but a sterile mutant, and the added psychic distortion due to your inferiority complex passed us by. We allowed only for a megalomania, not for an intensely psychopathic paranoia as well. It is myself that bears the responsibility for having missed all that, for I was the leader of the Second Foundation when you captured Kalgan. When you destroyed the First Foundation, we found out, but too late. And for that fault, millions have died on Tazenda. And you will correct things now? The Mule's thin lips curled, his mind pulsing with hate. What will you do? Fatten me? Restore me to a masculine vigor? Take away from my past the long childhood in an alien environment? Do you regret my sufferings? Do you regret my unhappiness? I have no sorrow for what I did in my necessity. Let the galaxy protect itself as best it can, since it stirred not a whit for my protection when I needed it. Your emotions are, of course, said the first speaker, only the children of your background, and are not to be condemned. Merely changed. The destruction of Tazenda was unavoidable. The alternative would have been a much greater destruction generally, throughout the galaxy, over a period of centuries. We did our best in our limited way. We withdrew as many men from Tazenda as we could. We decentralized the rest of the world. Unfortunately, our measures were of necessity far from adequate. It left many millions to die. Do you not regret that? Not at all. Any more than I regret the 100,000 that must die on Rossim in not more than 6 hours. On Rossim, said the first speaker quickly. He turned to Channis, who had forced himself into a half-sitting posture, and his mind exerted its force. Channis felt the duel of mind strain over him, and then there was a sort of snapping of the bond, and the words came tumbling out of his mouth. Sir, I failed completely. He forced it from me not 10 minutes before your arrival. I could not resist him, and I offer no excuses. He knows Tazenda is not the Second Foundation. He knows that Rossim is. And the bonds closed down upon him again. The first speaker frowned. I see. What is it you are planning to do? Do you really wonder? Do you really find it difficult to penetrate the obvious? All this time that you have preached to me of the nature of emotional contact, all this time that you have been throwing words such as megalomania and paranoia at me, I have been working. I have been in contact with my fleet, and it has its orders. In 6 hours, unless I should for some reason counteract my orders, they are to bombard all of Rossim, except this lone village, and an area of 100 square miles about it. They are to do a thorough job, and are then to land here. You have 6 hours, and in 6 hours you cannot beat down my mind, nor can you save the rest of Rossim. The Mule spread his hands and laughed again, while the first speaker seemed to find difficulty in absorbing this new state of affairs. He said, "The alternative? Why should there even be an alternative? I can stand to gain no more by any alternative. Is it the lives of those on Rossim I'm to be chary of? Perhaps, if you allow my ships to land and submit, all of you, all the men on the Second Foundation, to mental control sufficient to suit myself, I,
may countermand the bombardment orders. It may be worthwhile to put so many men of high intelligence under my control. But then again,